the workers on the SB line for strikes at out of call. But Casey Jones, the engineer, he wouldn't strike at all. His boiler, it was leaking, and the driver's on the bum, and the engines and the bear, and they were all out of plumb.
Casey Jones
kept his junk plow running.
Casey Jones
was working double time.
Casey Jones
got a wooden medal for being good and faithful on the SB line.
Hey, Chris Garlock here with this week's Labor History Today.
Within the next few days, well over 200,000 postal workers nationally were on strike, and the Postal Service was effectively shut down.
That's longtime labor lawyer Jules Bernstein, who was counsel for the Mail Handlers Union during the 1970 postal strike. We sat down recently to discuss that historic strike. Also this week, the Mini Labor Archives gang has dug up a couple of speeches from the early 70s by AFL-CIO President George Meany, responding both to the Watergate scandal and then to Gerald Ford's unconditional pardon of Richard Nixon.
This also can lead to a widespread consensus that we have a dual standard of justice in this country, one for those in high public office and one for those who do the bidding of those in high public office.
Here's the show.
They said it wasn't fair for Casey Jones to go around a scabbing everywhere. The Angels Union number 23, they sure were there. They promptly fired Casey down the golden stair.
Casey Jones,
I went to hell and lying.
Casey Jones,
the devil said opine. Casey Jones, get busy shoveling sulfur. It's what you get for scabbing on the SB line.
Jules Bernstein is a Washington, D.C.-based labor lawyer who's advocated for workers' rights for more than a half century. He's represented several of the country's largest labor unions. In the 1980s, he sued the Postal Service after discovering that postal employees were not being properly compensated on the job and were not being paid for work performed at home. Following years of litigation, 500,000 postal workers won retroactive wages and damages. While counsel to the International Brotherhood of Teamsters, Jules helped organize the March on Washington for Jobs and Freedom in 1963. He and his wife, Linda Lipset, operate a mom-and-pop labor law firm in D.C., where they specialize in Fair Labor Standards Act litigation. Back in 1970, Jules was serving as counsel for the mail handlers when 250,000 U.S. Postal Service workers went out on strike. That strike officially started on March 18th, but it really started the previous day, as Jules told me over lunch recently at Rare, the union restaurant in the Laborers Building in downtown Washington. I mentioned that not just to explain the background noise you'll hear, but because it was a very appropriate place for this story, since the mail handlers are now part of the Laborers Union.
On the 18th of March of 2020 will soon be celebrated as the 50th anniversary of the great postal strike of 1970. In my mind, March 17th, the prior day, should also be recognized, because it's the 50th anniversary of a critical meeting of Branch 36 of the National Association of Letter Carriers, which covered Manhattan and Bronx in New York City. At that meeting, an activist rank-and-file member, whose name was Vincent Sombrato, called for a vote to strike the Postal Service to protest extremely low pay and miserable working conditions in the face of large increases in the cost of living. As a matter of fact, many New York City letter carriers with large families then qualified for and were receiving welfare. There had been strike talk among the postal workers for at least a year, at a time when unionized public employees in New York City were being paid much more than postal workers. And so the members voted 1,559 to about 1,000 in support of the strike. And the next day, they put up picket lines at postal facilities throughout the postal service in New York. And many other postal workers and unions members respected the picket lines and went on strike. frankly, within the next few days, well over 200,000 postal workers nationally were on strike, and the postal service was effectively shut down. And so during the couple of weeks after that, there were tremendous efforts to get the strike settled, and that is a very interesting story in which President Nixon and his administration had to settle a wildcat, unlawful strike by a couple of 100,000 postal workers, giving them collective bargaining, raises, and helping to enact labor management provisions for postal workers, which included coverage under the National Labor Relations Act, and final and binding arbitration of contractual disputes. So that's a really major anniversary of an important turning point in American labor history.
Let me just ask you a quick question, just as a follow-up. Did I understand you said that you were involved or connected, or so what was your...
I was counsel for the mail handlers division of the laborers. And I played an important role in the whole damn thing.
Well, so tell me, what happened? So this wildcat jumps off.
So Nixon...
It's completely illegal.
Right.
They don't have rights to strike.
Not only don't they have rights to strike, it's a crime to strike.
Right. It's a federal crime.
You lose your job if you strike.
So how...
Nixon called out the National Guard, declared an emergency, and the National Guard...
couldn't sort the mail.
Exactly. So what happened is that Bill Ussery, who was an assistant secretary of labor, who came out of the machinist union, he got Secretary of Labor George Shultz to meet with the unions, and then he put a meeting together with the unions and the Postal Service. And at a certain point, the unions asked for the help of George Meany at the AFL-CIO, and President Meany became their spokesperson and settled the whole damn thing in the White House with Nixon.
That was longtime labor lawyer Jules Bernstein remembering the historic postal strike of 1970, which started 50 years ago this week. As a result of the strike, postal workers won substantial wage increases, the right to collective bargaining, and the first of many subsequent negotiated labor contracts. Look for a longer piece by Jules on the strike this week in the American Prospect at prospect.org. President Trump was impeached just a few months ago and then acquitted in early February. Since then, before the coronavirus pandemic pushed everything else off the front pages, there was a lot of talk about possible pardons. So the Meany Labor Archives gang thought this was a good time to take a look at how labor responded during the Watergate scandal. And they've dug up a couple of speeches by AFL-CIO President George Meany responding to the Watergate scandal in 1973, and then to Gerald Ford's unconditional pardon of Richard Nixon in 1974.
Hello, everyone. We're here with another segment of Cool Things in the Meany Archives. I'm the archive specialist, Alan Weirdak, here with the labor archivist, Ben Blake, and our student assistant, Chloe Danio. Today, we're going to talk about impeachment and pardons through the lens of George Meany's Office of the President files. There's a series of about six boxes on speeches, and they're all in chronological order. So while I was pulling speeches for a 400-level communications class here at the University of Maryland centered on speeches and social justice, I came across a speech from May 22nd, 1973 that George Meany gave before NBC TV on the Watergate scandal, and a speech from September 10th, 1974 that Meany gave before the International Brotherhood of the Electrical Workers in Kansas City, Missouri. So we're actually going to start with the first speech on May 22nd, 1973. So this Watergate scandal speech, I'll just read it verbatim. It says, "Trade unionists, like Americans generally, are gravely concerned by shocking revelations in the Watergate scandal. Must not forget American system of justice, rights of individuals protected, innocent until convicted by due process of law. However, it is obvious that the revelations thus far have shaken public confidence in the integrity of their government. There is ample evidence of the illegal use of huge sums of money to cover up crimes that were designed to maintain the political power of the administration. Confidence in government can only be restored by letting the American people know the whole truth. Then Congress can take the necessary actions to preserve our free democratic political system. That system can survive if we know true... That word is actually unclear in this. I don't know. The true picture, I think, no matter how bad it is. Congress and the executive branch, yes, the president himself must cooperate fully and completely to see to it that we get the full and complete story of this shoddy mess. The American people can take it if they know the truth. No other answer will suffice. Any additional attempts to cover up will only further diminish public confidence. And then, Chloe, do you want to read the second speech here?
So it says, for immediate release, Tuesday, September 10th, 1974, and at the top it says, in a speech this morning to the Convention of the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers, AFL-CIO, in Kansas City, Missouri, AFL-CIO President George Meany made the following comment about President Ford's unconditional pardon of ex-President Richard M. Nixon. The country is just emerging from a terrible national nightmare. Richard Nixon and his co-conspirators have moved out of the White House, and the executive branch of our government is now under new management. The new management looked fairly good until a couple days ago. President Ford's unconditional pardon of former President Nixon for any and all offenses that he may or may not have committed while occupying the highest office in the land raises serious questions about the integrity of our judicial system based on equal justice under law. I have said publicly many times in the past few weeks that I personally have no desire to see an ex-president of the United States, any ex-president, in jail. I had assumed that the normal legal process in the Watergate case would proceed, with those charged or under suspicion of breaking the law receiving the due process guaranteed under the Constitution. I had the feeling that President Ford might exercise his right to pardon our former president if he were to plead guilty or to be convicted of a crime. And I'm sure that if that happened, many Americans would have approved the action. But now we have a situation where one citizen, who has not been indicted or legally charged with any crimes, is given an unconditional pardon against any and all possible offenses. What can be the effect of this on our judicial system? What can be the effect of this on the investigation, the continuing investigation into the scandals of Watergate? Well, it could have the effect of completely halting that investigation, and the final effect would be the American people would never get the truth about the involvement or non-involvement of the chief executive. This also can lead to a widespread consensus that we have a dual standard of justice in this country, one for those in high public office and one for those who do the bidding of those in high public office. I'm afraid the Watergate nightmare is still going to be with us for some time as the result of President Ford's action. In the meantime, what happens to our traditional belief in a government of law rather than of men? What happens to our basic belief that we brag about, of equal justice under law?
All right. So for a little bit of context on this, the first speech, the Watergate scandal speech in May of 1973, was actually during the Senate hearings around Watergate, which I was not alive for, but anyone in our audience that was alive for, I guess, would know that these were publicly broadcasted on major networks. So one question I have is if this speech on NBC TV was part of those Watergate broadcasts, because the way I understand it, each network would be broadcasting on Watergate every third day. Between, I believe, NBC, ABC, and CBS. So that was something that interested me just kind of off the jump. But I guess the one context that I'm thinking of is just government accountability and the public trust in government. And also one thing I was thinking about is how, you know, the AFL-CIO president was out making public statements around Watergate and impeachment and pardons. And I did a quick Twitter and Google search of anything that current president Richard Trumka has said around either issue, and I couldn't find anything. So I thought that was interesting as well. So I don't know, what stands out to you all about these speeches here?
Well, there's really no talk about, like, what happened, like, what went down. It's all about, like, this is the effects on the public consciousness, basically. So that seems like it's kind of the lasting impact, maybe, but I don't know.
Okay.
I think the speech, while the hearings were going on, that looks like it's a segment, kind of a prepared statement that probably aired on NBC TV. There's a notation on the document. It's very interesting because we have four kind of drafts of it. So it kind of is really, and probably one of them is in George Meany's handwriting.
Yeah.
So it's really, really cool stuff. And it provides a really good record for somebody to go back and check the date and find out what actually was aired on TV. Yeah. And if we were talking about this earlier, whether labor actually got a voice on the TV.
Yeah.
It looks like probably did. And mm-hmm. it kind of shows where, you know, I have not seen any reporters ask Richard Trumka what he thinks.
Yeah.
But back in 1973, they did ask George Meany. And I think that today, for an organization that represents 12 million workers, you'd think the media would pay attention. But I think it shows how everything has kind of shifted in terms of, you know, the media now is much more concentrated and much more conservative.
How it just seems like the political punditry on both sides of the coin doesn't really value the perspective of organized labor.
I think that's really true. I mean, I find it even in strike situations, I'm waiting for them to, you know, say, well, when are you going to interview somebody from the union? I remember the UPS strike. I remember I was listening to NPR on that. They never interviewed anybody from the Teamsters. And and that was in the 90s. But this is kind of a similar thing. And I guess that shows why archives is important. You know, it shows that legacy that otherwise people might not know about.
Yeah.
And
what stands out to me in this first speech is the concept of the whole truth and the connection between transparency and confidence in government. And I think that we are definitely in this moment where, like, there is no transparency and therefore there is no confidence in government. And I mean, what the historical record shows, at least through ledges like these speeches, is that this confidence in government is decades running now. And it's because of this complete lack of transparency.
That's such a great point, because people are starting to talk about the series post-truth. And you can see here George Meany basically crusading on TV. We've got to maintain the idea that truth is important, that facts do matter, and we can't let a president cover up the facts in an investigation. And he references the facts that millions of dollars are being used to cover it up,
mm-hmm.
which I don't remember that. Like, I was around, I was a senior in high school when this happened, and I don't remember anybody talking about big bribes to cover it up. And so it's a great example of, like, you know, documenting what's happening at the time, and then it comes in the archives, and now we're able to look at it retrospectively and learn the lessons of history and how they apply today.
And I think it's also really another powerful quick sentence in this speech is the system can survive if we know the true picture, no matter how bad it is. So it's this whole thing of, like, uncovering the full transparency of history and of what happens and not just seeing it from one perspective. And that's this lack of transparency is kind of it's crippling for, you know, the system of democracy, really. Chloe, do you have any thoughts from this second speech here?
Yeah, I think it's interesting that sort of towards the bottom, he's talking about a dual standard of justice in this country, one for those in high public office and one for those who work for those people. So that certainly hasn't changed. That's probably only gotten a lot more extreme. But it's interesting that that's kind of looked at as maybe an effect of this. I had never really thought about it that way, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, well, I guess, you know, talking pardons is a big topic right now in current events with the number of pardons that are being doled out by the current head of the executive branch. And, you know, so being mindful of that and being mindful of how these pardons are politicized. I think of the pardon of the woman. I know her first name is Alice. I can't remember her last name off the top of my head. But the woman that was pardoned, like the prisoner that Trump pardoned, essentially, and then he used it politicized in a bunch of his ads as basically trying to get votes from the black community, essentially. Oh. And but then a lot of his other pardons are Joe Arpaio, which I think a lot of our audience may know as the rather cruel and inhumane sheriff out in Arizona who did some very questionable things to immigrants out there, who then tried to run for public office, but was also pardoned by Trump. So pardons are a really interesting topic right now, and it's really interesting to see how the AFL-CIO president, George Meany, at the time was commenting on pardons to the electrical workers in Kansas City and just what the audience was like, what the crowd was like, how this was received, you know, what partisan politics looked like in the labor movement in 1974 compared to 2020. These are all things that I can't help but think about when reading through these speeches and documents.
And I think Chloe's point about this kind of two-tier justice, one for the rich and one for the poor,
for
the working class, it kind of intertwines with this, like, defending the truth. In this recent case in the National Archives, where there's a historian at Columbia University that's just broke in the last couple of weeks that a couple of National Archives archivists were fired because they were trying to recover notes that President Trump tore up into little pieces, and they were trying to tape them back together and get them in, because the Presidential Records Act came after Watergate to preserve right. those records, because Nixon was, you know, trying to destroy yeah. the famous tapes and things.
It's a crazy connection.
And it's kind of a combination of both, where these two archivists are fired. So that's the justice for them.
Yeah.
It isn't, you know, no justice.
Right.
Trump will never pardon them. And they'll never maybe get their job back. They're probably contract employees. And then it's part of covering up the truth.
Yeah.
You know, of, you know, that is a mode of operation that, you know, what our current president is doing is very similar to what Nixon did, but on, I think, a grander scale.
And I think what's another interesting statement in the pardon speech is, so I'm afraid that the Watergate nightmare is still going to be with us for some time as a result of President Ford's action. So he's almost saying that, like, by pardoning Nixon, it's almost like you're lessening a government accountability. Like, it's almost like it's like an admission of innocence almost, yeah. where it's like you're now no longer guilty for these really horrible things that you did. And so thinking about a pardon is that, you know, that way retroactively of.
Yeah, I think people say that. I mean, the pardon probably certainly ensured that Ford didn't get reelected, which is kind of funny.
I think that's a really important point. And I think that second speech also talks to the idea that by pardoning, it's sort of reinforcing the idea that Nixon got away with being essentially above the law, that he paid no price for that. And how important that is today is pretty evident.
Yeah, right. Like we currently, will, you know, could argue that we have an administration that is very, very much behaving as though it is above the law. And I think we are going to leave it there. So it's been another segment of Cool Things in the Media Archives, and the archive specialist Alan Weirdak here with labor archivist Ben Blake and our student assistant Chloe Daniel. All right, until next time.
Well, the workers on the SP lines to strike sent out a call, but Casey Jones, the engineer, he wouldn't strike at all. His boiler, it was leaking, and his engine's on the
bottom. That's it for this week's edition of Labor History Today. You can subscribe to LHT on your favorite podcast app. This week's music is Casey Jones' Union Scab, sung by both Pete Seeger and Mark Ross. Written by Joe Hill, it tells a very different story than the one that celebrates the skill and heroics of John Luther Casey Jones, born on March 11, 1863, in southeast Missouri. A member of the Railroad Engineers, Casey Jones was the sole fatality in a wreck near Vaughan, Mississippi on April 29, 1900. Joe Hill wrote the song shortly after the first day of a nationwide walkout of 40,000 railway employees in the Illinois Central Shopman Strike of 1911. It's a parody of the song The Ballad of Casey Jones, and is sung to its tune. Pete Seeger, of course, is the legendary American folk singer and social activist. Singer Mark Ross is a member of the IWW, just like Joe Hill, who wrote the song, and this clip is from the 1990 documentary The Return of Joe Hill, which tells the story of the wobbly songwriter and the legacy of the industrial workers of the world. Our thanks to Steve Jones for sending this in. Labor History Today is produced by the Metro Washington Council's Union City Radio and the Kalmanovitz Initiative for Labor and the Working Poor at Georgetown University. The Labor History Today team includes Ben Blake, Chloe Daniel, Patrick Dixon, Leon Fink, Sherry Lincoln, Joe McCartan, Jessica Pozak, and Alan Weirdak. For Labor History Today, this has been Chris Garlock. Thanks for listening. Keep making history and see you next time.
Scabbing on the SP line.